From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for July 4th weekend, 2019. Summerfest is wrapping up this weekend, and because I'm old, I don't know any of these bands. But I have heard of the First Place Brewers, who are playing the Pirates again this weekend, but this time it's in Pittsburgh. Well, July 4th is a day to celebrate America and sell cars. An Alabama car dealership is running a promotion. With every car sold, they're throwing in an American flag and a Bible and a shotgun. The only thing missing is apple pie. A Texas woman was banned from her Walmart after police say she ate half a cake while shopping in the store and then refused to pay for the missing portion. That would be the literal definition of half-off sale. And finally, customs agents in Atlanta found two giant African snails in a man's suitcase. The critters are about a foot long and 5 inches tall. And because they're snails, they were easy to catch. In the studio today, we have Art Rothschild, Dave Sandstrom, Paige Ratke. And with a look at the first half of 2019, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thank you, Max. It was a great run for stocks and bonds alike so far this year, with the 30-stock Dow Jones Industrial Average up 15.4% through the end of June. The broader S&P 500 added 18.5% in the first half, with a quick return to growth in June after what had been a weak May. Non-U.S. stocks have fared well so far in the first half, though the Europe, Asia, and Far East Index has added just 14% compared to the S&P's 18.5%. While it's rare for stocks and bonds to rally so significantly at the same time, most measures of short and intermediate-term high-quality bonds are up 3-4% or more, benefiting from declining yields on the intermediate and long end of the curve. The yield curve remains in focus as longer-dated treasuries continue to yield far less than short-term bonds. In addition to the yield curve, the first half has given us plenty to talk about. And rather than focus on the holiday shortened week, I thought we could use this episode as a chance to focus on some bigger picture items that are out there right now. For starters, the lack of inflationary pressure stands in contrast to low unemployment rates. Given that we're recording right before the 4th, it's worth pointing out that the average cost of a summer cookout for 10 people grew just 0.2% over last year, according to the American Farm Bureau. The meal, which includes 8 hot dogs, 8 burgers, 4 pounds of ribs, and all the fixings, came in at $52.80, or less than $5.30 per person. But it isn't just food. Commodity prices have largely remained in check, and despite the tight labor market, wage growth has increased only modestly. So, Dave, I wonder, you know, with the minimal impact of inflationary pressure, how are investors, or how should investors be positioning portfolios for that, and what should we expect, you know, going forward for inflation and what maybe that means for the economy and rates more broadly?
Kyle, you bring up a really interesting point, because I think it really plays into this record expansion that we've experienced now over the last 10 years. I think a lot of investors are starting to look over their shoulders, but make sure you remember that economic expansions don't die of old age. They typically die for a reason, and the usual reason is inflation. And like you said, it's pretty much non-existent. And you know, usually what happens is you get an overheated economy after this much time. You see inflation raise its ugly head, and the Fed will react by raising interest rates to quell that inflation, and typically brings about the end of that cycle. So here we are 10 years in, and we're looking at low to non-existent inflation. Gives us that opportunity that maybe this thing could go on a little bit longer. Even though we do see some clouds starting to begin to form on the horizon. I'll point out one thing quickly is the fact that this particular expansion, the growth rates have been fairly anemic. And in this 10-year span, the cumulative GDP growth is 25%. Put that in perspective with the number two expansion in the 90s, where that growth cumulatively was 42%. And then number three expansion started in 1961 for 106 months, was over 50%. So we're looking at some fairly low growth rates during this expansion, and that might give us a little bit of room.
Dave, I think that's such an incredibly important point. You look at how long this expansion has run, but we knew from the beginning that a recovery from a financial crisis would be slow. We knew that spending would be slow to come back. We knew that borrowing and lending especially would be slow to come back. And so that contributed early on to some of that slow growth. I think what's been interesting is in the later stages of this expansion, we've seen pressures from other areas perhaps that have continued to depress what could have been an otherwise pretty healthy growth environment. And so, you know, I'm absolutely on board with this idea that, you know, this phase of the expansion could continue on, could maybe muddle along, as it were. And I think the one thing worth pointing out is that we're starting to see some cracks in, you know, the rate of growth. That, you know, concerns are cropping up around the world about, you know, growth in Europe, growth in Japan. Even here in the U.S., now seeing the largest number of job cuts for the first half of a year since 2009, and those job cuts coming from the automotive industry, coming from especially retail and industrial, and, you know, signs that maybe the industrial side of the economy is slowing down. Important to point out that, you know, industrial or manufacturing, not the driver, the economic engine it once was here in the U.S., but, you know, still a critical component. And then you add in things like construction spending slowing. And I think, you know, there's some cause for concern on economic growth, even if it just means that we're in a slower environment. And so, you know, Art, I wonder if you have any thoughts on maybe how investors position for some of that concern, you know, maybe what we do in response to some of that.
If the past couple of years, Kyle, have taught us anything, is that we really don't know what to expect based upon what just happened. The past 7 months have seen stocks getting back to record highs, but along the way, it's been pretty volatile. It's like getting on a roller coaster at Great America or something like that. So going forward, I happen to agree with you. I think with the possibility that more people are going to lose their jobs, not due to anything cyclical, but more long-term, the trend toward you know, more automation around the world could result in people having less jobs, having less income. That could put more pressure on prices and keep prices down. Trade war, you know, has resulted in probably a reduction of corn prices, among others, or soy prices, because our farmers aren't exporting as much. The fact that we're pumping more oil in this country has forced OPEC countries to cut back on their production to keep prices higher. So we could see a continuation of pretty much what's been happening, meaning I think it's trade that's going to be dominating the landscape going forward. I don't think inflation is as much of a factor for investors today. You can almost take inflation out, you know, the equation, and then just build your balanced portfolios. On the long end, as we've discussed before, I'd be careful going out too far, you know, on the yield curve, because interest rates could go higher, surprise us the way they did at the beginning of 2018, even though we expect the Fed to lower rates. What if they don't? And even if they do, and if it's the wrong weapon to fight the problem that we have right now, which is slowing growth globally, which is caused by inconsistent trade policies, I think it's a time for caution. So don't overdo it. Have the right amount, whatever that is, for your risk tolerance in stocks, and remain relatively short, I think, in bonds. It's all from here.
You know, I think it's so interesting when you look at some of the prospects for slower growth and then you compare it to how great of a start to the year it was. You know, you look at low double-digit earnings or low double-digit growth for the S&P, for the Dow. You look at, you know, bonds doing as well as they did because of the direction of rates. And especially, you know, you look at the last couple of days, we've gotten record closes for the S&P 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average finally reclaiming those previous highs. And so, you know, I think it's interesting to try to juxtapose, you know, this idea that the markets are supposed to be a leading indicator. We have expectations, I think reasonable expectations, that things slow from here, and yet you've got the market that's pointing to a far rosier outlook. And so, Paige, I know, you know, maybe you have some thoughts on how we reconcile this idea that, you know, growth could slow and yet the markets are higher. And you know, the flip side of that, or maybe the other side of that coin, is, you know, rates are pointing to one thing and stocks are pointing to another. And so, you know, I wonder, you know, how we respond to that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're back at a point in the cycle where we're looking at bad economic news as being good news again, at least for the markets. So back in the fourth quarter, we had bad economic news. That was bad for the markets. Now that bad news has actually been quite a boost. So both risky assets in the equity side and the credit side have rallied. Develop equities, for example, are up 4% for the quarter, 17% for the year. And at the same time, safe haven assets like developed market, government bonds, gold, and the yen have also rallied. That seems pretty counterintuitive, right? Why should risky assets and more safe assets be going up at the same time? But really what we're seeing here is the market is pricing in those rate cuts, right? So if rates are going to go down, we have a lower discount rate, so a lower factor to bring future earnings back to today's dollars, which gives way for higher present valuations. And then at the same time, quantitative easing expectations in Europe and Fed rate cuts in the United States are supportive for government bonds.
You know, I'm glad, Paige, that you mentioned the valuation piece. I think so often we focus on earnings and interest rates, and you know, Brian Kilb talked at our last year's seminar about this idea that valuations play such a critical role in our expectations for stocks. And if you look at where valuations are today versus where valuations were at the start of the year, and you talk about, you know, some support maybe from interest rates supporting a little bit higher valuations, and yet, you know, at the start of the year, we were talking about price-to-earnings ratios on the S&P maybe being at a 4-5% discount to long-term averages. Now we're talking about maybe a 5-6% premium to those long-term averages. And so, you know, you add in that maybe the earnings growth is intending to slow down a little bit here. And you've got, on the one hand, those rates that surely are supporting higher stock prices. And on the other hand, you've got valuations that could be a bit of a headwind. And, you know, you've got more broadly earnings that could be a bit of a headwind. And so, you know, I think as we look to position portfolios, and Art, you mentioned balance, that's kind of the key to what we do. I think the other piece of that is that there's some changes that you can be making now to better take advantage of, you know, what's been a record high for stocks. You know, that tends to me to be a great opportunity to maybe consider what kinds of cash needs you have as an investor. If you're looking at taking an RMD at the end of the year, maybe you raise a little bit of cash for that now. Because you can sell at a high. And that doesn't mean that stocks don't go higher. It just means that at least today you know what you're getting. You know, I'd throw this one out to anybody at the table here. I know with a lot of stuff going on in the first half and a lot of stuff to look forward to in the second half, I wonder if there's, you know, particular conversations you're having right now or particular things that you're trying to do with your own portfolios that, you know, might be worth sharing with the audience.
Kyle, I think you hit the nail on the head. I've been talking to clients for the most of the second quarter about securing those cash needs for this year. And if you have something you know that's going to hit, if you've already planned on maybe it's the new roof or you got that new driveway landscaping project, maybe it's, you know, you just want to secure next year's income payments for your monthly withdrawals. I think now is a great time to do that. And you can do that without necessarily sticking your head in the sand and getting ultra conservative, but trim some of these winners that we've had over the last 18 months to 2 years, and you know, especially what we've seen in this in all of 19 here, and lock in some of those winners without, you know, getting, you know, carried away on the conservative side.
And Dave, I think you know, there's always some concern of you know, fear of missing out, that the market's just going to keep running higher, which again, it certainly could. Although there's plenty to suggest that, you know, the idea of taking some of those gains, of trimming some of those winners makes sense. And so, you know, I think you've got to balance that idea about, well, we don't want to bury our head in the sand here. We don't want to get too conservative. But at the same time, you know, as you say, take advantage of some of these great prices.
I'm going to suggest caution again. Last year at the end of September, we were up 10%, gave it all back in October, and then got clobbered in December. The one thing we have to be sure of is we can never be sure what's going to happen next. The drivers this week, quite frankly, we had a truce on the trade, you know, war. And that, but investors expected it. And so stocks moved higher. We're setting records. Yeah, but we're just getting back to where we were 7 months ago, because the end of last year was lousy. Not to mention this quarter, we did well in April, gave 5 or 6% back, you know, in May, and then we crawled back in June. So politics that we never want to talk about on this show, so I'm not going to talk about it right now, could have an impact on the markets. We have a presidential cycle in which the president can control the news, and I want to caution our investors not to pay that much attention to the news other than know what's going on, know how it can impact your portfolio, and again, make sure you have enough of your money in safe things, as we've all been discussing, so you can ride out the storm. Heaven forbid we have one, because we just don't know what's going to happen next.
And I think worth pointing out, there's some tactical shifts that you can make in an environment like this, where for years we had been talking about growth stocks as this thing that should lead us through, you know, maybe periods of a little bit slower growth than what we've historically seen, that we were willing to pay a little more to buy higher rates of earnings growth. And, you know, that was certainly rewarded. If you look at the way we've built portfolios for years, you know, growth has really been a key to that driver. But as, you know, as you mentioned, you know, some concerns and some risk of increased volatility, now you want to be less willing to pay up for that growth. And that doesn't mean you abandon it entirely. It doesn't mean that maybe you, you know, sell off all of those high-flying growth names. What it does mean is that you refocus your portfolio on some of those things that maybe matter a little more when we see increased volatility, and that's things like value stocks. You know, there's a reason why you call them value stocks. It's because you can get them at a discount. I mean, most often you look at those value stocks, they tend to be names that you can pretty easily predict what they're going to earn this year, what they're going to earn next year, what they're going to earn the following. You know, you look at something like a cereal maker or a soup maker, you got a pretty good idea how many cans of soup you're going to sell in a year if you're a business that does that. And so it's pretty easy to say, here's what it should be worth and here's what it is worth. If you can buy it at a little bit of a discount, you know, that makes all the sense in the world in this environment. I think the second piece for investors to remember is that what they're going to be getting from their portfolio is not limited to just the capital appreciation or the price movement. That more and more in an environment that volatility is coming back, dividends are going to be key to total return. And so, you know, that again plays to that value stock thing. And so what I think we'll see is a shift back towards value stocks a little bit. We saw it in June where the, you know, Russell 1000 Value Index led the Russell 1000 growth. We'll see if it continues. But I think, you know, that's going to be a trend that is more important now than it has been in a while.
Art, you brought up the comment about staying short on the bond side, which I think is really good advice. I would like to add to that, though, the avenue of staying on the high-quality side as well. If we do get into this easing again, the cycle of cutting interest rates around the world, I think you're going to see investors tempted to reach for yield again. And we got ourselves, I think, into a little bit of a precarious position right now with the amount of lower quality debt that's been issued in the last 18 months to 2 years. And if we start cutting rates again globally, I think you're going to see that expanding even further and making that potential risk even higher.
Definitely.
And Dave, even, you know, you and I were talking about this a little earlier this week, looking even at the high or the investment grade debt market. Triple B debt has now taken over 50% of that overall market, up from about 30% a few years ago. So not only looking at are you in investment grade, but also looking at what level are you in that investment grade to evaluate your bond portfolio from there.
Yeah, that's such a great point, Paige. You know, I think we focus on quality as the piece that gets us through these times of volatility. And, you know, while that triple B designation historically has meant investment grade or things that maybe you're at the very bottom end of, you know, what we long-term have thought of as higher quality bonds, I think this environment may be a little different for that triple B debt. You might want to consider moving into a higher quality space if you haven't already, because, again, that's the piece that's supposed to get you through. That's the piece that you're supposed to know is there. Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.